Okay, so what's going on that's going to impact the fall election? You know, I know we hear about gerrymandering all the time, and yeah, that's a big deal. We hear about other types of voter suppression, and we also hear about the risk, the threat of military forces being deployed to suppress or corrupt the vote. We talk about that a lot. We hear about it a lot. There are other factors, too, and I want to talk about three today specifically. First, Israel. What is the Israeli impact on the U.S. election? Well, you know, it's always impactful in Democratic elections for federal office. I believe that it's going to be impactful in the general election as well. And I say that because the optics of what's coming out of Gaza, Lebanon, the West Bank, it's all horrible. And it makes the Israeli government look horrible. And it brings into strong question our country's support for this regime. And it's going to get worse and worse before it gets better. So last month, a Pew Research poll found that 60% of U.S. adults have an unfavorable view of Israel. And that's up from 53% last year. And again, it's only going to get worse. So here's an example, I guess. There was a march last week in Jerusalem. It's an annual event commemorating when Israel took over East Jerusalem. And that march has never been kind to the Palestinian residents of Jerusalem. And it has become more and more extreme in recent years. And one of the highlights from that event was the National Security Minister unfurled an Israeli flag in front of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that mosque is one of the most sacred sites in Jerusalem. And there's no reason to do that other than to try to intimidate. You know, so this isn't just a bunch of Zionist yahoos. The Israeli government is going all out to make this event a big deal. They bust in marchers from all over Israel, including from settlements in the illegally occupied West Bank. So, and Israeli nationalists at the march, at the rally, at the event, chanted death to the Arabs, may your villages burn, and Gaza is a graveyard. And again, all that's being approved by the Israeli government. Yeah, I mean, either through silence or actually outright defense of the marchers. You know, it kind of reminds you of January 6th, right? Oh, peaceful protesters. So, you know, I'm happy to say that there's plenty of dissent within Israel. Opposition leader Yair Lapid called the march and festival, quote, a disgrace to the Israeli people and an insult to Judaism. Israeli peace and human rights groups apologized to Jerusalem's Arab residents. They passed out flowers to them, and they defended the journalists and activists who were roughed up and arrested by the Israeli defense forces. So the bottom line is, you know, I think it's hard for Americans, and again, most of us are decent people. It's hard for us to see a mob yelling death to Arabs or burn your village and not think that maybe U.S. policy of blind support for Israel's right-wing government has got to stop. I think that'll be an issue in the fall election. And even worse than that, I saw a headline. It just totally blew me away. Palestinians forced to destroy own homes. I think, what's going on here? Well, there are 57 homes so far on the edge of Jerusalem have been demolished, and there are 8 more now that are being designated for demolition. Of course, they're all Palestinian homes. And they're being cleared in order to build a biblical theme park called the King's Garden. I'm thinking, okay, which king? Well, it's King Solomon, of course, Solomon the Wise, who used to go there to get away from the burden of being king, I guess, to relax with some of his, 700 wives and maybe some of his 300 concubines. By the way, I'm not making those numbers up. He had 700 wives. He had 300 mistresses. Yeah, how's that for family values? Anyway, so maybe not so wise, huh? So everything about this whole process is so rotten. Even if you do like the idea of a biblical theme park, the King Solomon. So the worst part is that the government is requiring people to be evicted, who are being evicted, to pay for their own home's demolition. So one homeowner, I guess that's a contraction, homer. One homeowner I read about in The Guardian was told it would cost them $100,000 to have the city workers to come in and demolish his home. He realized that he could hire the equipment and workers and pay $10,000, which is still a crazy amount of money, to destroy your own home. Destroy your own home. So, I mean, I'm still, I don't know how to understand this. You know, you take my land, you, the government, or some big corporation, in this case, the government, you take my land and I have to pay you to do it. You know, that's like a pipeline company, to take an issue close to home here. A pipeline company who's been given the authority to use eminent domain to then charge the farmer for the cost of digging up their land to install the pipeline. Okay, we're going to come in and we're going to dig up this big trench here, put this pipeline in, and then you're going to pay for it. Or you can do it yourself. I mean, it is absolutely insane. There have got to be zero Americans who think this is a good idea. Zero. I mean, how can anybody think this is a good idea? So, you know, this hard far-right crazy coalition running Israel is so out of control. And it's getting worse. And again, my question is, will these atrocities impact the U.S. election this fall? Well, if people know what's happening, it will. So get the word out about this. This stuff is crazy. And I think that analogy I just made is spot on. You know, charging pipeline victims, people who are in the line of the in the way of the pipeline, charging them for the work of digging the trench. That's what this is like. So, you know, and this is all happening on top of so much else. I mean, there's the violence in the West Bank, illegal settlers and soldiers coming in, you know, taking property, killing people. The rape of Palestinian women. I heard about that. I looked it up to make sure it was true. And yeah, according to an online query, there are multiple credible reports and testimonies indicating that Palestinian women have been subjected to rape and sexual abuse by Israeli Defense Force soldiers. How many people in the MAGA universe are going to be swayed away from voting for any candidate that thinks Israel's doing a great job? Okay, there's also war crimes in Lebanon, the target of civilians, healthcare workers, journalists. We've had thousands of casualties, and there are now 1 million people in Lebanon displaced. I'm hoping that more and more people pay attention to this stuff, and I can't imagine paying attention to it and not thinking, hey, yeah, this, you know, our government's support for this is wrong. And it's a bipartisan problem. I'm not saying it's all Trump at all, but it certainly has gotten worse under Trump. And the rubber stamp of the Netanyahu administration is like nothing it's ever been before. The second thing I think that's going to impact the fall election that doesn't get talked about a lot was talked about recently by David Sirota in a piece he wrote called "The Liberal Fiction That Will Lead to Trump." I'll quote him. He says, "The Democratic elite has convinced itself that Republicans and Democrats, including Obama, joining together to bail out bankers who were throwing 10 million families out of their homes had absolutely nothing to do with Trump's rise." And I would add, spot on, David, I would add that Democrats' support for so-called free trade treaties also helped Trump get elected in 2016. I would also add that Democrats' unwillingness to champion the plight of so many rural voters in so many different ways, but in particular, having their land threatened with eminent domain. And this is not just that's not just an upper Midwest problem. All over the country, there are reasons why people are having their land threatened with eminent domain. That's a huge issue that Democrats have avoided. Anyway, Sirota goes on to say, "Liberals and country club Republicans need to believe Trump flipped over 200 Obama counties for any and every other reason than the economic cataclysm of the late 2000s and the government's pathetically weak response to it. They need to believe that because that way, they can still tell themselves that we can go back to a pre-Trump, quote, normal of professional liberals and country club Republicans getting rich in yuppie information economy gigs while working class voters are economically massacred by both parties' deregulation, free trade, and neoliberalism." And he nails it. He absolutely nails it. And so enter the new face of the Democratic Party. And I say new face, but again, I mean, I was talking like that 30 years ago or more, 40 years ago. And there are plenty of other independents, Democrats, and even some Republicans who are talking that way. But again, it gets bowled over by this, they call themselves centrists, but they're really just the establishment, the corporate establishment that doesn't want to see any change because, you know, they've gotten so comfortable. They don't want to see their little world flipped upside down. And so that's why you saw a whole bunch of people back in 2016 saying, yeah, I like Bernie Sanders. Second choice, Donald Trump. So, you know, when the Democratic Party kills any possibility of Sanders actually prevailing in the Iowa caucuses and beyond, then you come up with a Hillary Clinton and by default, electing Donald Trump. Things are finally, I think, really changing because it is clear that the Democratic Party that has been dominant for the past 20 years or so is DOA. There's nothing left. It's just the flip side of the corporate beast. And we see that most clearly in Graham Plattner. He's the populist Democratic candidate who is now the Democrats' U.S. Senate candidate in Maine. He was running against the candidate that everybody thought would win, Governor Janet Mills. I mean, how often does a sitting Democratic governor not prevail in a primary? Well, I guess you can get beat by an oyster farmer. She was trailing so badly that she has dropped out. And so, as Robert Reich writes, yet the Democratic establishment, corporate Democrats, wealthy Democratic donors, entrenched Washington centrists, the Democratic senatorial campaign, etc., still don't get it. The Democratic establishment didn't get it a decade ago when Hillary Clinton was the presumptive Democratic nominee. And not incidentally, Jeb Bush was considered the shoo-in for the Republican nomination. So this is a bipartisan phenomenon. Both voters in both parties are tired of the status quo. They know that a coalition of Democrat and Republican insiders refused to help them out when millions lost their homes in 2008. They also are aware that a huge bailout was given to the industry that caused them to lose their homes. And it was a bailout that was not a loan because it was never paid back. It only counts as a loan if you pay it back. So, so they're voting for the candidate that most disrupts the establishment. And that's been, I mean, we can get into why Biden slipped in there. but we'll see. I mean, 2028 is a long ways away. But right now, the Republicans have a lot of challenges ahead for the midterm election. But their biggest asset is a lame Democratic Party, which is starting to shift, but we'll see if it actually shifts enough to make a difference. Finally, the third thing I want to mention, Trump's inner circle. Robert Reich, who was once on this show, had an interesting thing to say about this. I think this conversation has more merit than you might suspect it does at first blush. There were people who met with him who alleged that there was a plot to oust Trump as president. And I have no idea how viable this is, neither does Reich, but it's worth discussing. So again, Trump's war in Iran, it's a failure. It's going to continue to fail. It's going to continue to raise gas prices, continue to raise food prices. And more Republicans are going to start turning against Trump. We're already seeing that. More and more of that's going to happen. Besides, Trump's mental decline will become even more obvious. And that's two presidents in a row now that we had to witness, you know, mental decline while in office. So faced with this, here's what Reich writes. J.D. Vance promises Marco Rubio that he'll appoint him vice president if Rubio joins Vance in seeking to oust Trump under the 25th Amendment. Rubio agrees. Vance and Rubio then approach House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, however you say it, for confidential discussions in which they broach the possibility Johnson and Thune give Vance and Rubio their tacit support. Okay, this is moving all right, right? So Vance and Rubio then get Pete Hegseth to sign on, promising him that he'll keep his job. Then they get Todd Blanche to sign on by promising him he'll be appointed permanent Attorney General. So you got Vance, Rubio, Hegseth, Blanche, and that's what Thune and Johnson need to make the 25th Amendment stick with a vote in Congress. So the arrangement, again, it suits everyone's interests, Vance and Rubio. It avoids what could be a messy 2028 primary election. So Vance will be president, but then Rubio will still be young. He'll be the heir apparent in 2032. He'll only be 60 years old. So as president and vice president, Vance and Rubio end Trump's tariffs. They end his war. And that causes the increase in gas and food prices to abate. Maybe they come down a bit. And suddenly, Republicans aren't so worried about what happens in the midterm election. Yeah, it's not an unthinkable possibility. I think it's a very real possibility. The guy that Reich was talking with said he gave it like a 30% chance of happening. I'm going to give it more like a 50 to 60% chance. We'll see.